Accession number 11883, Mr. C. Anson, Reel 1.
Mr. Anson, Reel 1. Could you tell me, first of all, where you were born, please?
In Berlin, 1922.
And what did your father do for a living?
A fairly varied career, but at the time he was managing director of an industrial film company, which in due course came to grief. So my first two years of my life were spent in Berlin.
And can you tell me something about your family?
Yes, my father came from a Jewish family who lived in Silesia and were moderately well off, had a brewery and a theater in the town of Glatz, which was Prussian, of which he was always inordinately fond, because Glatz was a fortress that had never ever surrendered, not during the Seven Years' War or any other time. But due to this fact, there was still an ordinance that in the late 1800s that no permanent building was permitted to be erected in the glacis of that fortress, which could not be instantly demolished in case of war. And so said brewery and theater were in one wooden-built complex and unassurable. And when the whole thing went up in flames about the year 1912, it was the end of his business, and he went to Berlin and joined the Foreign Office, and was supposed to have gone to Turkey eventually, I believe, as a commercial attaché, but the war intervened. The First World War intervened.
Were your family interested in politics at all? Were they involved in politics?
Yes, in the sense in which after the war, my father, perhaps through his previous experience in working for the Foreign Office, joined the new Reichswehrministerium and became what was abbreviated into head of the political department of the Reichswehr under the first ever social democratic Reichswehr minister, defense minister Gustav Noske, with whom he became subsequently very friendly. He was no kind of a socialist, but he conceived a tremendous respect for the social democratic governments of the time, and especially for Gustav Noske, in the courage these people had to get hold of that incredible chaos and tremendous mess and make something of it when the whole of Germany was disintegrating. And when they managed to establish something in the Weimar Republic, something more solid, and it was his particular job to counteract the vociferous influences of the time when there were Soviet republics being established here and there. And it was the intention under von Seeckt to create and maintain the Reichswehr as a non-political tool of the Republic in general and the President in particular. And until the right-wingers took over, this really did succeed, and my father was involved in various ways in those very turbulent political times to try to establish means of keeping those influences from the Reichswehr itself. And he, for instance, established, he introduced sports in the German army. It sounds a bit odd, but there always had been gymnastics and drills and all sorts of things, but competitive sport as a medium for giving them a positive interest in those very vociferous times. He established people's high schools in which they could take courses in which to acquire academic background and qualifications of various sorts. He made it its business to establish all sorts of means of introducing positive influences to keep the Reichswehr away from these corrosive influences, from political influences, from the right and left.
What about your family's attitude towards religion? Were they believers or atheists?
Well, my father was more a Protestant because I suspect, because he was very fond of organ music, and Johann Sebastian Bach in particular, and loved going to church. My mother was Protestant anyway and came from an old North German family of Dutch origin originally, and she came from Bremen.
Do you remember the National Socialists coming to power in Berlin?
I do indeed, but we weren't in Berlin at the time. The business venture had collapsed. We had moved, and my father was traveling a lot, so pro tem, in the year 1932-33, my mother and I lived in the north, not far from Bremen, St. Magnus near Fegesack, to be near her various relations, while my father tried to establish himself in business, which he did eventually, and after that we moved down to Bad Homburg, where I saw my sort of primary and early school years.
What did you see of the events of the takeover by the National Socialists?
I tended to be swept along a little by the great enthusiasm of the time when the Nazis won a majority and everybody was wearing uniforms, marching along, flying flags and singing songs, and it seemed very exciting on the surface until my father pulled me up short and said, "Have a closer look at what's happening." But he quite deliberately stayed away from political activity for a while because he felt that one shouldn't judge too quickly, that if one gave them enough rope, they'd hang themselves. If, in the old German phrase, nothing is eaten as hot as it is cooked. And I think he was also nervous of appearing to be influenced by the fact that he was of Jewish origin. I hadn't even known, because he was non-religious, or certainly not. I'd been brought up as a Protestant, and we were really a Protestant household. But I think he then made a point out of pride of making it known that he was of Jewish origin, and he did not want to make it appear as though he adopted political attitudes merely out of a personal opposition, because the Nazis opposed the Jews, and it took about a year before he tried to do something about it.
What did he try to do?
Well, he started to visit his old friends in Berlin in the hope of being able to help in the setting up of some kind of an opposition, but I'm afraid the generals, who would, of course, not have anything to do with these vulgar upstarts, nevertheless felt that it might be quite an advantage to have a nationalistic government which might be good for the army, and they hope to control things. They realized much too late that they had the tiger by the tail and failed to control it.
Presumably, at the time, you knew nothing about your father's activities.
I did know a little. He was always outspoken in his opposition to the right-wing extremists, or, for that matter, to left-wing extremists. After all, he had served in the Reichswehr Ministerium at a time in which the left wing was the more militant, and at the time of the Spartakist rebellion and real armed uprisings, which were not just a matter of street riots, but of units with artillery and armored cars. But he made no kind of secret, again out of pride, of his ideological opposition. And I didn't have a very pleasant time at school as a result, because I also, after that, realized that it wouldn't do to be swept up in that kind of excitement, and I suffered for not conforming.
How specifically did you suffer?
By being bullied and beaten up a lot.
Were you required to join the Hitler Youth?
No. And I wouldn't have been able to do that because I was half Aryan or half Jewish. But I did join a Protestant youth organization known as the Bekar, the Bibelkreis, Bible Circle, which was an absolute psychological lifesaver, because it had high moral standards, and at a time when everything conspired to make one feel very isolated and begin to wonder whether one really was the only person in step, and whether it was really all the others had gone mad. And when your school friends came back from some sort of a camping holiday as little Nazis who had quite changed in personality and attitude, it was a great psychological salvation to be with people where you could feel at home, and where the same standards were still considered valid. It was rather like the Scouts, only a shade more religious, and we used to have Bible readings and things like that, and also read adventure stories, play games, go hiking, have summer camps, and it made life rich, and it certainly made a good deal of difference to me.
How old were you when you were in that?
From the age of 12, I think, until about 15.
So from about 34 to 37?
Something like that, yes. Quite right.
Which town were you a member of it in?
No, we had moved to Frankfurt meanwhile, because things had turned very sour business-wise. And our circumstances were reduced. My father found it difficult, because of his views, to get it. It wasn't under the circumstances of the day. He was not a good person to know. His business suffered as well. He acted as an independent publicity advisor, marketing advisor. And it was better not to have to do with people with his reputation.
What was your own attitude towards the regime?
Well, I detested it once my father had opened my eyes. That was only, the enthusiasm was only a very short initial reaction to the general excitement of the day. At age 11, one gets easily swept up with the enthusiasms of one's peer group and environment.
Did you feel before you left Germany that a war was coming?
Yes, we were absolutely certain of it. And I remember various occasions when my father made it very plain that he knew it absolutely. One was, for instance, when Goering made his famous guns, not butter remark. And he said to me quite plainly, well, that means war, because if you have butter, you can either eat it or you can export it to pay for imports. If you make guns, you can use them only for one purpose, and that's to conquer other people and eat their butter. And there were many other occasions. One I remember very clearly was when the Locarno Treaty was overturned by Hitler, the Rhineland reoccupied the previously demilitarized zone, and my father sent me to the main station in Frankfurt on my bicycle in order to bring back from a sort of ticker tape machine they had there the news that the French and the British had sent units to reoccupy the Rhineland. And he was bitterly disappointed when the Allies simply didn't act. And he then felt again that the bully had got away with his arrogance and that this was inexorably leading to a war. And I think I felt then what became more and more obvious, that this man who was a very patriotic German and had been a patriotic German and Prussian indeed all his life, had become disgusted with being a German. He refused to read German newspapers. He only read Le Temps and The Times. He was hoping for the Allies to take a hand in order to stop this obscenity that was going on in Germany. And he became increasingly reckless because he came to the conclusion that it was simply no longer worth living under those circumstances. And his recklessness eventually cost him his life because he made remarks which were reported, as a result of which he was arrested, even taken over by the Gestapo, sent to a concentration camp at Dachau, and there killed on the 15th of October 1937.
Was he not terrified by the thought of showing any opposition?
I once put that to him because he gave quite a public dressing down to a person who had been enthusing about the Nazis, I forget in what particular context. And when we had passed on, I said, "But Daddy, isn't that rather dangerous? Why do you say these things?" And he said, "Do you expect me to act like a coward?" And never said any more on the subject.
Which foreign countries did the public and the government seem to show most hostility to in Germany?
Oh, I think it was France, which was traditionally an enemy. And I think that the sort of arrogant contempt shown by the Nazi extremists towards the decadent democracies with their parliamentary talking shops and the compromisers was underlined by the interwar political history of France with its frequent changes of government, various corruption and other scandals, and other manifestations of decadence which made the Nazis very contemptuous towards them.
What was the attitude towards Britain?
Respect. I think that Britain has always been regarded with considerable respect, and as a more closely related nation, I found during the war that there was often a reaction on the part of prisoners that showed almost a resentment that we hadn't made common cause with them, because we were, after all, Aryan and related, and the British had built up a tremendous empire, and the Aryan races were destined to rule the world. Why on earth did we want to turn against Germany?
Once your father was sent to Dachau, was the family able to maintain any contact with him, or was all contact lost?
No, not really. There were two interviews, because the first phase consisted of my father being taken into protective custody, as they used to call it, which was police custody, at which my mother was allowed two brief interviews. And during the first interview, talking mainly of domestic things. My father also said, well, look, I don't know how long I'm going to be in here, and it's getting cool, it was autumn. I would like my heavier winter suit, and have you mended the sleeve lining? And my mother said, what do you mean, sleeve lining? And he said, God's teeth, I've told you 100 times, I've told you once, the sleeve lining wants mending. And when they kissed goodbye, he whispered, the sleeve lining is important. So when she came home, we went through all his suits and found rolls of documents in one of the sleeves and had a bonfire in our flat. And when next she saw him, she was able to reassure him that the sleeve lining had been mended. But that was the last we saw of him and the last contact, except for heavily censored letters. And they literally censored them with scissors. They used to cut them to bits.
What was the nature of these documents?
They would have implicated other people he was addressing, ranging from prominent people and military people to Gustav Noske and people like that, in trying to get together in order to try and do something about the political situation.
Were any of these military people any of those who later became involved in the July plot?
That I don't know.
So you don't know any of them by name?
No, I did go with him once to visit a charming and terribly civilized, elderly, retired cavalry general who lived in the Frankfurt area. He was such a nice man, but I do not know the people he tended to visit. He used to fly off to Berlin to visit them and try and set something up. The only person I do know quite well, I did know quite well, was Gustav Noske, the above-mentioned defense minister, who after the Nazis, in the first place, resigned at the time of the Kapp Putsch in 1920, I think it was. And my father resigned with him at the time. Noske became Regierungspräsident of the province of Hanover and was deposed eventually by the Nazis when, to our surprise, Göring made time during a public speech over the radio to denigrate Noske and run him down in a very personal manner. After which Noske retired and came to live in Frankfurt, and by that time we also lived in Frankfurt. The friendship was renewed, and we saw quite a lot of them, Noske and his wife. And we used to go on day picnics together or visit each other and have dinner together and that sort of thing. And I still cherish a gift from Gustav Noske, which is a little 200-year-old lady's pistol by Adams of London, with which he presented me. I'll show you in a minute.
What kind of a chap was he?
He was a large, impressive man with a deep voice and, I think, uncommonly like Ernest Bevin, except that Bevin had a high, squeaky voice, whereas Gustav Noske had a deeper, rolling voice, had grown up in a trade union movement in the, last decade of the 19th century and first of the 20th, when trade union movements in Prussia demanded some courage. He became a leader, a union leader, I believe, of the saddlers and leather workers. I'm not terribly sure. But he became a prominent person in the trade union and political democratic movement. And that is how he came to be called on as a person whom the workers and the soldiers trusted when the social democratic government was established immediately after the revolution in order to try and help to bring order out of the chaos of the revolution itself, the disintegration of the armed services, the establishment of soldiers and workers, Soviets, the Kiel revolt, which he very courageously and almost single-handedly, I won't say suppressed, because it was a matter of diplomacy, not of armed suppression, after which he became defense minister and established the Reichswehr.
When you say he was like Ernest Bevin, do you mean he was somewhat rough in manner?
Yes, not in an unfriendly way, but very direct.
What did his morale seem to be in those days after the National Socialist takeover?
Stony and steadfast. He didn't expect anything positive. He very nearly shared the fate of the military, revolting, of the military people who tried to revolt against Hitler. But while he was actually arrested and put in prison in the Alexanderplatz prison in Berlin, he was still there by good luck, very probably, and alive when the Russians liberated Berlin and he was set free. I saw him again after the war, while I was still in the army, and he was back again in Frankfurt, Sachsenhausen. That was the last time I saw him.
How did you come to leave Germany yourself?
After my father was killed, it became obvious that there wouldn't be much of a future for me, and all manner of avenues were explored for immigrating here, there, and everywhere. There was an uncle of my half-sister, the daughter of my father's first marriage, who is 12 years older than I am, and this uncle was going to Cuba, and we were trying to get the necessary documentation. It was a scramble by all sorts of people, mostly Jewish people, trying to get out of the country in circumstances when it was being made very difficult to get out. And there was an enormous weight of red tape and many obstacles to overcome. It eventually became possible through sponsorship of the Quakers, of the Society of Friends, to get me attached to a children's transport on the basis of a temporary transit visa to Britain, which in turn was founded on the fact that I had applied for immigration into the United States, who would accept the application and give you a waiting number because they would accept immigrants, but only a certain quota. And the German quota was, of course, in those times very greatly oversubscribed, so my turn would probably have come around in 1955 or something, sometime which was a bit irrelevant.